This is Care and Compliance in the Real World, a podcast from CAC, part of the Baldwin Group. Hosted by Peter Winterburn and Erica Holman, this podcast brings together decades of experience in senior living, healthcare, risk management, and compliance. Drawing on backgrounds in law, insurance, operations, and senior care leadership, they sit down with industry experts to explore the real-world challenges organizations face every day. Each episode delivers practical conversations and actionable insights to help you navigate risk, strengthen compliance, and better care for the people you serve. Let's get started.
Hello, and welcome to the latest edition of Care and Compliance, your CAC Group Senior Living podcast. Today, we'll be talking about infection prevention and the infection nobody saw coming. In June, 2026, an Ohio jury awarded $2 million after a resident developed septic shock and subsequently died. The jury did not find the facility contributed to the death directly, but contributed to pain and suffering. The resident had a urinary tract infection, a UTI, and the family's complaint wasn't that the UTI occurred. Their complaint started because nobody told them the resident had a UTI and that it was getting worse before it turned into septic shock. And now I'd like Amy, my guest, to discuss a little bit about that.
Well, from where I sit, that's a resident story first and a surveillance story. Somewhere in that timeline, there was a change in condition that should have triggered a documented assessment. It's a missed opportunity. It didn't get flagged as an infection-related situation until it was too late. The lawsuit downstream is a surveillance gap.
That's right. So today I'm hosting Amy Huff, an RN, certified in infection control, LTC-CIP, and an APIC-AIPC credential holder, which means if you're keeping score, Amy has spent her career specifically in the infection surveillance and program side of this work, not just in general nursing. Amy, it's so good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. And you made me sound super smart, so thank you
for
that.
Yes, it's my pleasure.
Fair warning, I'm going to keep pulling us back to what does the surveillance definition actually require? Because that's where most of the problems start.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think inconsistency is the most common antibiotic stewardship failure that I see in skilled nursing. Some residents receive antibiotics for a positive urine culture and they have no localizing symptoms. Other residents have symptoms that are missed because, and I quote, changing condition documentation is vague about what's happening.
That's so true. It's something that I've been battling on my own. We have people receiving antibiotics when I'm questioning, do they need to? And others, how did we miss that? So let's start with asymptomatic bacteriuria. That's a fancy way of saying bacteria that's not hurting a person at all. There's no localized symptoms. It's really common. Up to 56% of female residents in nursing homes will have asymptomatic bacteria at any given time. And if they have a catheter, they'll have even more risk for asymptomatic bacteriuria.
I have a sidebar question. Do we still see a lot of catheters being used in skilled nursing?
Yes, we do. And it's such a risk. There's no wonder that it comes up on reports and gets flagged for surveyors to look at.
Okay.
It's a huge risk.
Okay.
So the standard that I train our staff to is mapped not really so much to the Loeb criteria. If you're familiar with Loeb criteria, you'll know that's what physicians use to decide to prescribe antibiotics. The McGeer criteria is not about diagnosing. No, it is about benchmarking. When do you count something as a UTI? I can't just say, oh, Mrs. So-and-so just seems sickish and then count her as whatever infection. They have to have specific symptoms. So that's how I train our staff. Before calling the physician about getting an antibiotic, can you point to an actual localizing clinical symptom?
That's a good point.
So what things do we look at? You probably already know. Acute dysuria or a fever, rigors.
You know what? I have to ask you to use English. So when you say acute dysuria. What does that really mean?
That's burning with urination.
Oh, that sounds horrible.
If you've ever had a urinary tract infection, you know exactly now what I'm talking about. We look for worsening, a pattern of worsening symptoms. And what I usually look for, does the note talk about the specific symptom that justified starting the antibiotics, or does it just say, what do you think?
Oh my gosh. UA positive?
Yeah.
Bactrim started?
Yes.
Okay. Wow, I'm so smart.
So that gap is the whole ballgame from a stewardship compliance standpoint. We talk about antibiotic stewardship and diagnostic stewardship. When to order those UAs and when to order those antibiotics.
I love that. So let's start off with a case file. Let's have some fun here. So we have Mrs. K, 84 years old, indwelling catheter with moderate dementia. Now, moderate dementia, that could fluctuate. On day one, we notice she's more confused than usual, and the family visiting notes she's not herself. Now, this is charted by a registered nurse as a baseline dementia fluctuation. What does that really mean?
It's a clinical judgment. It's not anything.
Well, I think especially, you know, if we have moderate dementia, we've probably done a dementia assessment. We probably have a code for what it means to have moderate dementia. And someone, maybe the social worker, would be alerted. Gosh, there's a difference in how she is behaving cognitively. I'm just throwing that out. Okay, day two, low-grade fever, still charted as monitoring. Right. Okay, we're going to get to monitoring because that is my pet peeve. I think you know that about me.
Oh, that's how I learned
it. Yeah, you learned it. So then day three, found unresponsive.
Oh.
Found, that's another word. Transferred, sepsis secondary to UTI, dies later in the hospital.
It's a lot to unpack. When you go back to day one, that's the miss. It's not even a swing on this. Nobody even swung at that ball. Now, we know that according to the McGeer criteria, a change in mental condition isn't indicative of following a path to diagnosing a UTI or investigating for a UTI.
Right.
But it means it should have triggered a documented assessment, vitals, hydration, looking for those localizing symptoms. I probably will sound like a broken record. I always ask, what are the symptoms? In even a confused person, you may note that they wince when they're urinating, that they have symptoms. They're rubbing their back because they have flank pain, which is pain over the kidneys.
Yep.
And now day two, that low-grade fever, that should have clinched it. It should have closed that loop for us because fever plus a change in condition with an indwelling catheter. Okay. I saw the catheter and I thought, oh dear, here we go.
Right.
That's the combination that should prompt physician notification and family notification. And a workup, not monitoring.
Yes.
And by day three, we've lost that window that this was a UTI instead of sepsis. So how do we fix it?
Yes, that's what I want to know.
Well, it's not real complicated, and yet it is. It's not just about training staff to diagnose anything. Well, they can't.
Right.
It's about training them to recognize that they have to dig deeper and look further.
I want to say a couple things. I have to jump in. One of the most common things I see in a chart is the family saying mom wasn't herself. Nurses will actually document that. And then there's no follow-up. I see that a lot with UTIs and with sepsis. And so I think we should listen to the families. Hey, if they think there's something a little bit off, they know mom the best. Now, this is also a good time for us to discuss two things. One, I will touch upon briefly, which is the use of the word found in any documentation. You know, if we've found something,
were they lost?
Yes, exactly. Did we miss something? Right. Now, the next one is probably my biggest pet peeve ever. Monitoring. We overuse it. And I know that as nurses, you're trained to use that word.
I don't use it anymore. I trained myself out of it. Because what does that even mean? It's kind of a nothing word. And usually to close out my note on an infection, I simply write care continues.
Yeah.
Not will continue to monitor.
Yeah.
Who's going to monitor? Yeah. What are they monitoring?
Yeah. And that's perfectly on spot. If we're going to say monitoring, it means I am monitoring something. What am I? I'm monitoring for fever. I'm monitoring for dysuria. Whatever it is, we have to be specific. This is something that comes up in so many claims. A fracture, a pressure injury. What are you monitoring? I'm a broken record about monitoring. Say what you're monitoring. Pass it to the next shift. And when the monitoring is done, care continues. Refer to the care plan, whatever. So now let's talk for a second about all the problems that happen with those missed opportunities that Amy discussed. First and foremost are the survey and regulatory aspects. So F80 and F81, which are kind of the crown jewels of the infection control citations, right? Well, yeah, right. Amy's singing praises over here. For this particular case study, there was no evidence that an antibiotic stewardship criteria was applied at the point of care. So this, now from my perspective as a longtime operator, that could be cited as a G for actual harm. It could even be an H if there was a pattern of people with indwelling catheters who had UTIs, right? Okay.
Absolutely.
And it could even become an immediate jeopardy if the survey team believed the facility was deficient in their protocols. Other deficiencies can arise out of this, and it depends how standardized the processes are at the building. You could also be cited for care plan development and resident rights deficiencies because it becomes a negligence issue. Next cheerful part of this is the litigation. And with this particular documentation, we see there's a gap that would support the idea that there was a failure to monitor or a failure to notify, which is the same as the Ohio practice we discussed earlier. There are ongoing sepsis-related claims and suits all over the country. They're going on in Iowa, California, Texas, Michigan, and more. When we look at the claims about sepsis-related verdicts, the settlements against operators have ranged from low hundreds of thousands to tens of millions. When we look at sepsis, this is a top-tier severity driver. I want to touch on something that I learned a lot about when I was presenting with a physician. Yes, Amy, I have a physician friend, Amy, who is in the sepsis world, and he has pointed out that sepsis is considered the single most costly condition to treat because it can cost up to $28,000 a day. And overall, the treatment of sepsis by healthcare in this country is $52 billion.
Oh my.
Yeah. Billion a year. And it's actually expected to be higher than that this year. So more than $52 billion.
It's a good reason for owners and operators to really think about their infection prevention program and be involved.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So in this situation, the infection didn't kill their case. That baseline dementia, that's what was the noose around their neck.
You know, you just brought up something really great that we didn't mention. I don't think we're going to really touch on it, which is the root cause. What's the root cause? When we look at this, we didn't look at the fact that the dementia could have given us a really good clue to look more closely. The other thing I want to point out about a sepsis protocol is a lot of people are trained to only look at high temperatures. And as a non-nurse, I often think about low temperatures as well. I'm always curious.
Low temperature is an indicator or can be an indicator. It's something we track. We monitor for that.
Oh, do you mind? All right. So let's go on. Let's talk a little bit about the NHSN. And this is the reporting requirement nobody reads twice. I still see so many deficiencies related to this. As of January 1st, 2025, NHSN, which is the National Health Safety Network. Okay, thank you. Respiratory illness reporting decided that it is a permanent requirement. Weekly data on facility census, resident vaccination status, and confirmed and hospitalized cases for COVID-19, flu, and RSV.
And let me tell you, NHSN reporting fatigue is real. Mm-hmm. And that's why lapses happen.
Mm-hmm.
It stopped feeling urgent once it stopped becoming a pandemic era emergency reporting. But the obligation is a permanent infrastructure. And elements are added to and not usually taken away. It's just It's a fixed requirement that may grow or sometimes shrink a little. And someone needs to have this on their calendar. So I asked the listeners to think about, should it be the operator? Should it be the owner? Does it have to be the infection preventionist, the DON? Really, we know that more than one person holds the key to this and should all have access to perform the reporting.
I have a question about that. When this first started, it seems like you could only have two people per facility enrolled to load data.
I only remember they said at least two.
Oh, at least two. Okay.
I think that's what it was. Okay. I could be wrong.
Okay, I'm going to keep that in mind. So when we're looking at NHSN, from a survey perspective, we know that it's cited at F884 and 885. It's often reviewed off-site by the surveyors, and it's independent of any clinical outcome. Mm-hmm. And I look at hundreds of surveys annually, and I see this all over the country. The problem is you might not have a negative clinical outcome, but it counts towards your points. So it can impact your star rating on health inspections. It's a very real problem for operators. Then from a litigation perspective, we see that reporting lapse can become a corroboration of evidence that there's a systems failure. And then, of course, from an insurance claims perspective, because it's a factor in a survey history, underwriting can look at that. And so it's really important to make sure you've got a good system. So even if you have a perfect outbreak response, you can still get cited for a form. I think also in the beginning, the system was really hard to use. I used to have to do the reporting when it first started, and it was miserable. Mm-hmm. It was really, the system would fail, but there'd be
it has
outages.
Not changed much.
Oh, okay. That's good to know. Yeah. Good to know there's consistency.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So now let's talk about the one we thought was over. Let's talk about measles.
You know, I was reading about measles this morning. Mm-hmm. In Pennsylvania, so far this year, there have been 202 confirmed cases, none of whom are vaccinated.
Wow.
They are not unvaccinated people getting this. So I thought that was worth noting. I know there's a lot of controversy, but it's worth noting that the people who've had it have not had the protection.
I want to go on the record. Everyone's going to do what they want to do and what's best for their families. I understand that. I'm old enough that I remember seeing classmates having measles. I was young. It was before the 70s. And at one point, I read a few years ago that there were physicians who had never seen
measles. That's what's happening across the country. And in the article I was reading about Pennsylvania, they're like, well, I guess this is my opportunity to learn what measles looks like. And because it had been eradicated. Oh. Most of our residents in our long-term care settings are born before 1957, mm-hmm. so they have presumed immunity. Mm-hmm. And most of our residents who are younger should already have documented vaccination history on file. But there is the possibility of exposure mm-hmm. from staffs, visitors, and I bet almost no facilities are really digging into that. Yeah. So it's a new item to add to your employee health file review. Yeah. It's not hypothetical.
Yeah.
There's no treatment for measles.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's containment.
Oh, because it's a virus?
It's a virus. It has to run its course. Rapid isolation of a suspected case is your best bet for keeping it out of your facility. So when you have staff that need to be trained, have them flag any rash plus fever presentation.
Okay. That's good to know.
Flag it. Yep.
Right now, we know that there's no dedicated FTAG yet. It's going to fall under a general infection prevention inadequacy or adequacy under F880. Litigation, we have no idea what's going to happen. This is an entirely new pattern. And because we are serving a population that mostly has been vaccinated, we don't know what's going to happen with claims. It's an airborne pathogen, so we know the risk is higher.
It's one of those situations where a policy about emerging pathogens would be helpful. Mm-hmm. I just had a really smart friend help me write one. Nobody's infection prevention and control binder has a measles tab yet, most likely, but we're about to need one.
So let's see. Let's do some rapid fire takeaways.
Check your charts. Have some fun with it. Audit your charting for vague change in condition language. Bonus if you find monitor somewhere in there.
Oh my gosh.
And decide for yourself, do you think that that's a weak link that could be strengthened? Look for your vitals. Who notified the physician? Who notified families? Find out what's really going on.
The other thing that is critical is name the person by title who owns the weekly NHSN submission, and then make sure that there's a second and third backup, and have people check that work. Have someone go in and make sure it's up to snuff. One person alone can't own it. This is where we get into trouble in long-term care. We try to silo things and it's never effective.
And we didn't even touch on the annual attestation.
Oh, yeah.
That we have to do. And that is a little bit more involved. Mm. So make sure that you're giving support to the person who does it, or else participate in it.
Yeah.
Think about pulling your staff files and checking their MMR status.
But we have to be careful from an HR perspective about who's getting into that medical file for the employees, right?
It's best to have the employees sign off that, yes, you can check my immunization registry.
Okay. So before we close out, I want to just talk about a couple things related to infection control. I am reading a really fantastic book right now.
Mm.
It's called The Great Epidemic. And it's by John Barry, and it is about the influenza epidemic of 1918.
Goosebumps, but not because I'm sick.
Yes, thank goodness. I do have a fan blowing on you, so that could also be. The book is so interesting. I'm almost halfway through it, and I haven't gotten to the war yet or influenza because the buildup is so fantastic.
Yeah, they have to lay that foundation.
I had no idea that the risk of influenza is not just the flu itself. And I want to make sure people understand influenza is a respiratory problem. It's not a stomach flu. Stomach bug is a stomach bug. Influenza is a respiratory. Here's what I learned, though, which is the secondary infection of pneumococcus, right?
Yep.
Is what kills people with influenza. Is that right?
Yeah, pneumonia.
Yeah, I had no idea. I didn't realize it progressed like that. I thought, oh, you just said like had a lung collapse because of the flu, not because there was another infection.
It's not always another infection. Okay. Influenza alone can be severe enough, mm-hmm. but it's typically that secondary pneumonia that comes in.
Now I want to bring up another topic, and I'm always interested in public health. For example, prior to the 1910s, there was a real push in America for public health to clean water. And that is one of the things that came up in these massive military camps. They had dirty water. They didn't have clean
water in the book, Erica.
Yeah, I'm not that far in the book. That's right. I'm still in the 1860s, Amy. I see people not thinking about water contamination from a Legionella perspective or Legionnaires' disease. And I know we've talked about it. And to be fair, I did poo-poo Mrs. Huff about Legionnaires' disease, which I take much more seriously now. But I mean, how much should we be thinking about that?
Every facility is required to have a water management program and within it to address the risk for Legionella and what they're doing to mitigate the risk and to meet that line in the sand or in the water.
That was funny.
I don't know if you can make a line in the water. Anyway, in fact, I was just working on my Legionella stuff week, so that's fresh in my mind.
Oh, that's good.
Making sure your temps are the right levels. It's so backwards sounding to me that Legionella grows when it's, you know, warmish. Your biggest risk is cold water that gets warmed up.
Oh, wow.
So store your hot water hot and then cool it as it's going out.
Well, that's very interesting. Well, years ago, I learned that automatic faucets activated
motion
sensor are a higher risk for Legionella because of Mrs. Huff. Also, I want to ask one question, which is really important for people who have animals. Is it nationwide or is it just specific to the Midwest that rabbits cannot be in facilities?
I believe that's nationwide.
Okay.
You know, and rabbits just are not a good, they're bitey. They tend to be
bitey. Oh, I didn't know that. Because we have cats.
I know.
Should we not? Probably shouldn't have facility cats.
I'm not really
into
bringing any of the animals in from an infection prevention standpoint, but I sure like to cuddle all the animals, so I understand.
I don't want to get too controversial. I mean, we've talked about all these other controversial things. And
I know.
The rabbits and the cats could really push people over the edge.
That's too much.
The takeaway is keep going. You can never take your foot off the gas. Like, you're always going to be working on this and kind of issuing huge edicts doesn't really help people buy in to good infection prevention. And keeping in mind that people come at this from different perspectives. So figure out, what's the best way to get people on board for great infection prevention? And sometimes infection prevention nurses are frustrated because it feels like, oh, we're just doing everything retrospective. There's been an outbreak and now we're dealing with it. And I encourage people to be maybe more like Mrs. Huff and her colleagues and be thinking ahead, because that makes it much more exciting.
It does, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
So from being boring. And
yeah.
Also, when you see changes happening, help the staff dig in and help them know what to look for. It's huge. Getting them excited about infection prevention can be very rewarding.
Yep. And so I think when we look at this, to me, the number one risk that I see for operators and providers is related to sepsis and missing those symptoms. I mean, there's infection galore. I won't get into all the infections that are risky. So none of the problems that we've talked about are new. What we're seeing is there are old problems that get new exposure. We see that our documentation is vague. We see that there's a report that we forgot about. We see a disease that people thought was gone.
That's well said.
Thank you.
And every one of them goes back to that same root fix. Surveillance happens.
Yes.
Right at the point of care.
Yeah.
In real time, not later. And I remember it was a Tuesday because,
yes,
afterward, because I'm going to tell you, your memory will not save you.
Amy, I'm so glad you were here with me today. I really appreciate this. I'd like to remind everyone, this has been an episode of Care and Compliance in the Real World, brought to you by CAC Senior Living, a specialty practice of the Baldwin Group. Thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Care and Compliance in the Real World, a podcast from CAC, part of the Baldwin Group. If you'd like to learn more about today's topic or how our healthcare specialists can help your organization navigate risk and compliance, we'd love to hear from you. Visit cacgroup.com or connect with your CAC advisor. Until next time, thanks for listening.